Hello, it's John Pollock, and this is a special free sample of the most recent edition of Book Club, a show that Neil Flanagan and I host on a monthly basis for our Double Double and Espresso members. On this month's show, we are chatting about Under the Black Hat, which was Jim Ross's second biography that he released in 2020, along with Paul O'Brien, talking about his tenure in WWE, his tumultuous relationship with Vince McMahon, and many other topics, including signing with AEW in 2019. So we're going to give you the first 20 minutes or so of the episode. The full show is 2 hours, and if you would like to upgrade to the Double Double or Espresso tier, you get the entire show, and this comes out monthly. Next month, we're going to be chatting about Say Hello to the Bad Guys, Mark Raimondi's new book that is coming out this week, covering the history of the NWO. So here is Neil Flanagan and I starting things off with our thoughts on Original Sin by Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson of Axios, and then getting into Under the Black Hat. Welcome to the June edition of Book Club. I am John Pollock, and my reading partner himself, Neil Flanagan, joins me. Today we are going under the black hat. Is that, did you coordinate your hat wearing for this month's topic?
I did. I'm kind of wearing dark blue for those who aren't watching. And the nearest I could get to a hat that fit the look was a black one.
Just under. Under the real digital black hat.
Exactly, yeah.
All right. Well, we are here to talk about Jim Ross's second autobiography that he put out. This was back in 2020, but we're going to, first of all, get Neil, what is on your reading list besides this Jim Ross book? Is there anything that you have been focusing on of late?
Well, I can say Snap, John, because I know that you mentioned this to Way on a podcast fairly recently. The book about a very well-researched book around the allegations of cognitive decline of Joe Biden.
Yes.
By Jake Tapper, and I'm blanking on the guy from Axios who co-wrote the book.
Yeah, this poor guy with Axios who did like a ton of the reporting, and everyone associates this. I'll pull up the name while you talk about the book. But yeah, I also read
this. Tapper is so well known, and he's a guy I actually quite like as an on-screen news deliverer, you know, so I was intrigued to read this because he seems to be better known for fiction. He's written a couple of novels, which I haven't read.
Yeah, I haven't read any of Jake Tapper's books in the past. By the way, it's Alex Thompson at Axios, yes, who is the reporter who also worked on this with Jake Tapper. Alex. But this is like, I think everyone has at least heard of this. This is one of the, you know, seminal political books of this period of time. Like it's very rare you get a book like this that has this level of attention to it. And I think it's the proximity to the election, what's going on now as a result of this. And you also have this, there has been praise for this book. There's also been great, disagreement over this book as well. But I mean, to deny that this thing was like, they spoke to over 200 people. Like it's very well reported book. And I found it to be very compelling. Like I enjoyed the book quite a bit.
Me too. It caught an awful lot of criticism, and I thought I'm going to have to read this book to make up my own mind about, you know, what's going on. And my conclusion is that a lot of the critics probably haven't read it. They've probably heard a pricey of it or, you know, something like that. But as you said, they interviewed something like 200 people. There's some extremely good sourcing going on. I think it's pretty clear to everybody that you know, even those who haven't read this book, that Biden, when he was running, talked about being a bridge to next generation. Like his first term was supposed to be, it was never explicitly presented as I'm going to stay in office for one term, but that was what everybody took.
It was the working theory, and certainly nothing that Biden clarified or pushed back on. Like that was the line that he used about him being a bridge to the next generation. And just when you see some of the examples in this book, like the argument has been, well, yeah, the age was a huge topic of discussion. Yes, very valid, but I don't think anyone, unless those in the inner circle, were quite understanding of just how much he was not up for the task of this job for the next 4 years, and certainly into question of how effective he was when you couldn't even schedule events for this guy after a certain hour of the evening. And the fact that here was a guy that was frequently a a voice of the Democratic Party that would go on all the Sunday shows. And here was a guy that was largely contained during these 4 years. He was put in very carefully selected outlets. You know, we saw press conference gaffes of his, like all these things that you combine. Is this person equipped to be running for office for another 4 years? I don't know how you come to the end of this with the result of, yeah, he could have done another 4 years of this. And then it comes to the question of how much Kamala Harris's campaign was hurt by having such a truncated campaign to run against Trump and being in the unenviable position of trying to represent change while being attached to the outgoing president in Joe Biden.
Exactly. Yeah. And at a time when the administration sort of writ large was catching the criticism, as they always do when the economy isn't going well and prices are going up, inflation is high, all of that. But yes, very, very short run that she had when everybody knew that Trump was going to be the candidate long before there were, you know, long before no one decided to enter into a primary contest against him. Yeah, very good book. I would recommend it even to those who feel like it's been labeled as a hatchet job, or it really isn't. You know, I feel like it does present a fairly compelling account. And like you said, we all saw, you know, anyone with an interest in American politics saw that debate performance. And Joe Biden has always been known for the odd gaffe and the overcoming of a childhood stammer, which I think, you know, he's never been the best orator. But some of the excuses that were being floated about and some of the briefing to the press that this guy, oh, you should see him. He's as sharp as a tack, you know, in the Oval Office. And it's kind of, you know, who they were trying to fool when they knew that this man was going to have to campaign in public.
Mm-hmm.
A misstep by the Democrats and on a big scale.
Yeah, it comes at a time when we won't spend all of our time here on maybe this should have been our choice this month because it's a pretty timely book. But, you know, it's at a time when the Democratic Party is in, I don't want to say like chaos in the, it is in a certain level of turmoil, but it's also one in which I think this party can at least break itself down to assess, and they're going to have to do this very quickly for the midterms in 2026, much more for the 2028 race, is what this party is going to represent. And looking back at what have we gotten wrong? Why have we lost such a younger, the implication was that, you know, through Obama and just through just the politics of the Democratic Party, that as the voting base got younger, It was just going to sway so much. And that's not been the case. The Republicans have made a hard shift and gained a lot of younger voters that are now like more likely to vote Republican. Why is that? And you can ask a lot of, you know, soul searching questions of what your party is. What is it not servicing to its voting base that ended up with like the argument that, well, are we in worse shape with Donald Trump running this country versus a diminished Joe Biden? Well, the fact is the country voted for Donald Trump, and that is what was made. And you have to ask yourselves a lot of deep, difficult questions. And I think that's part of this book, that it's very uncomfortable for a lot of Democrats to assess themselves and come up with like a cogent strategy and where they're going to move forward. Like whatever you want to say about the Republican Party, save for kind of this current infighting that they're having over the Iran situation. Mm-hmm. Like when there is a objective in mind, man, do these Republican leaders and their base come into lockstep. And that is not the case with Democrats by and large, where there's, you know, it's tons of open disagreements and mixed messaging, and that can be good for debate, but it is like, Republicans, they grab onto a message and boom, they march forward with that message. So that's it's a very existential time, I think, for this Democratic leadership.
And you look no further than the courts. I mean, in Trump's first term, the objective of the people around him and Mitch McConnell as well in the Senate was, let's get as many conservative judges into the judiciary, you know, not just the Supreme Court, but everywhere as we can. And I think that's something that's, will outlast Trump's presidency, particularly at the Supreme Court level. But we're doing we're nearly 10 minutes in, and we're doing a review of a different.
We will definitely do another political release at some point this year. Just quickly over the last month for me, I did follow up on our discussion of Watergate by reading The Secret Man by Bob Woodward that came out just after the death of Deep Throat.
Yeah.
Which I'll admit, like I was very aware at the time when Mark Felt was revealed as Deep Throat. I did not know the severe mental decline that Mark Felt went through during the last years of his life, where I mean he was just like he was like battling dementia and could barely remember anything from this period of time. And this book becomes Bob Woodward's kind of conflict of whether or not to reveal this source and who is alive but is hardly the man he was in the early 70s when he was the key source for Bob Woodward. So it's an interesting book. It seems like it was thrown together really quickly. Like it was just a matter of weeks that he got this book out in 2005 after Mark Felt died. But it was sort of Bob Woodward's final big look at Watergate, which is the story that will always be most associated with him. Yeah. So.
And it's so funny that, peculiar funny that it's, he's such a key figure in the Watergate story. And yet I can't often sort of just get Mark Felt's name in my head. And this guy was number two in the FBI, an absolutely key source that they probably wouldn't have been able to do the reporting they did without. And yet the name always escapes me when people sort of go, well, what was Deep Throat's real name? You know, it's very interesting thing. He was in his 90s, wasn't he, whenever the name was finally officially released through this book.
Yeah. Like it's a real interesting one. It felt as though like the family was comfortable with the name being disclosed. Like Bob Woodward seemed to have like a very like adamant view on disclosing this and would have. You know, his idea was that when Mark Felt dies, he would disclose the name. You know, everyone's going to have their different opinion on that. I don't think I would have any of that urgency to, like, for the sake of history, just to reveal who, like, some key source was. Like, I don't think I would. Like, I just, if that, like, just reading this, like, it makes you think, like, what would you do if you were in a, like, any kind of a situation like this? But he felt it was important to reveal this guy's name.
I think that is an interesting debate because at the time, Mark Felt was on very deep background, and one of his conditions was not only you can't quote me, but you can't report that I'm a source. I mean, even, you know, so in a sense, when they wrote All the President's Men, Woodward kind of broke that agreement, and you know, even at that point, you know, to sort of but how can you tell the story without including?
Yeah, Deep Throat? And the movie goes very far, like when you watch it, in terms of like you know, we had to cast someone in his likeness, and you know that movie comes out in what 76. Yeah, it's a very interesting one, probably you know, and maybe the ultimate pseudonym that's ever been assigned to.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper? But brought us closer to it. Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
It's June on the Post Wrestling Cafe. We are going through tons of your questions on the Ask Away Mailbag Show, and we're bringing you not one, but two editions of Rewind Away, including a review of the Katsuyori Shibata documentary, California Dreamin', covering his time as head trainer at the LA Dojo. Plus, Karen and Bruce have you covered for New Japan Dominion. Chris from LA has chosen another musical edition of Rewind Away to join Wei Ting and Nate Milton. Plus, we have extended editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown coming at you every single week, along with all of your weekly favorites. It's postwrestlingcafe.com.
Sure.
Any kind of source as well.
Especially its origin, which yes, I think everybody yes. knows.
But. I mean, the biggest scandal at the time in American history, and it's got its roots in porn. But today we are going under the Black Hat. This was Jim Ross's follow-up to his book Slobberknocker, which covers his upbringing, his time in Mid-South, in WCW, and it takes you into his entryway into the WWF in 1993, and through kind of his, you know, most of like the 90s period in the WWF, whereas this book kind of picks up from WrestleMania 15 in 1999 onward. And what is significant about that show is that several months prior, Jim Ross had been calling a pay-per-view in England. This is when he gets the news of his mother passing away. And then on the air, he undergoes his latest fight with Bell's palsy. And this takes him off of television at the time. And this is when Michael Cole is put in his seat. And in the lead up to WrestleMania, they actually bring Jim Ross back to television as a heel, where, I mean, it is very visible the problems he is having with his, you know, partial facial paralysis, and trying to make him into this heel character that the audience so did not want. And it's at the request of Steve Austin and The Rock that Jim Ross come out and call their main event match in Philadelphia at WrestleMania. And it was just Jim Ross coming out and having no idea if he was going to be used again. He was going to be used for this main event. They sit him out on Raw the next week. And then he just gets the note from Vince, you're back on Monday. And from there, he was back to the races. So this kind of kicks things off, Neil. Yeah. But I think this book, it is as much about Vince McMahon as it is Jim Ross. Like, that is part and parcel. Like, his relationship to the WWF and its ebbs and flows are concurrent with his relationship with Vince McMahon, which is, you know, they certainly have their highs together, but it, so much of this, like, it is a real psychoanalysis of a very unhealthy, I would say, employer-employee relationship.
Yeah, it's McMahon. There are several key figures in the book that sort of loom large in pretty much every chapter. Jim himself, of course, aside. His wife, Jan, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But Vince is the other sort of star, if you like, of this book. And just it's an incredibly dysfunctional relationship that these two have. There seems to be moments of respect and heartfelt appreciation, but all too often just really unacceptable degradation, the sort of stuff that would not fly in any modern workplace. And, you know, I have a list of them actually that we can probably get to at some point.
Oh, there's stuff in here that, I mean, I should say off the top. So this book came out in, I think it was March of 2020. And a disclosure off the top, before this book came out, I think it was like several people that were given, you know, the manuscript of this. I was one of them, just asked to like proofread it. So I do want to give that disclaimer out that there was no compensation or working for anyone, but I was just asked, hey, just read this. And if you note any mistakes, I do want to get that out of the way as well. But it was in reading this that, like, a lot of this stuff with the Michael Cole angle and, you know, the Dr. Heine stuff, like, I had lived through all of this and watched it, but then it certainly struck even, like, it was certainly in poor taste at the time, but then reading how Jim Ross, what he was going through processing all of this, like, if there was any idea of – you know, this was just a character he was playing and there was no personal damage being done. Like, this blows that out of the water of just how excruciating this was for him. And like, we'll get into several of these instances that it's heartbreaking at times to see somebody that you're almost just rooting for this guy to break up with this person and leave throughout so much of this. And he has such an attachment to this company that he cannot walk away and still to this day has a certain devotion to Vince McMahon. Mm-hmm.
I think the Dr. Heine thing in particular struck me as just beyond the pale. You know, I managed to track down the clip. It seems to be scrubbed from YouTube. Like, if you can search for it in many ways, Dr. Heine spelt various ways, skit, JR, colon, skit, you know, Vince mocks. Yeah. And you get lots of results. You get people talking about it. You get clips of Jim doing interviews about it. You get analysis of it, but you don't get the clip itself. I finally found it on Daily Motion. It's nearly 8 minutes long. Feels like 80. And it is just grotesque, you know. And I'm sure I saw it at the time and probably didn't really have the deep feelings I have about it now. But there's just so much about it, particularly post the Janelle Grant lawsuit, where it's very hard to see Vince McMahon through any other lens now. And you think, you know, with Nurse Slobberknockers there, you know, is this sort of like in a push-up bra and stuff. The whole thing is just grotesque.
Like, it's
deeply unfunny as well, which is,
it's one of the most transparent segments when it comes into Vince McMahon's psyche and what he sees as entertainment and humor. And it wasn't lost on me either that we're reading this at the exact same time Jim Ross is going through colon cancer surgery again.
Yes.
And what was the difference that we saw of, like, could you possibly fathom AEW, forget a segment like this, making light of this in any form or fashion on its broadcast, and any company for that matter? And here we are in 2005, and while a guy is going through major surgery, like, he's not going in there to get like a mole removed, okay? He's going in there for colon surgery to get a portion of his intestine removed. Like, this is major surgery. He is hung up at home, barely conscious after he's like resting after the surgery. And they call him saying, tune in tonight. Yeah. We've got something for you to watch. And his wife is in tears watching this. Like, this is a psychological torture that I cannot over emphasize of the cruelty involved here and the ability of a Vince McMahon to just mess with this guy to such a degree.
Incredible. And of course, damaging, not only to hurtful in a huge way, not only to Jim, but to his wife, you know, who is crying and asking what is wrong with him. So to anyone who had a notion that Jim Ross was okayed, you know, for this thing or whatever, no, he was actually told it was going to be a medical update on him. And he, you know, you really should tune into Raw tonight to watch this. It's just unbelievable. It also got me thinking about this sort of old adage of Vince that he would never ask people to do something he wouldn't do himself. It's a slightly different set of circumstances, but can you imagine in Vince's absence when he's having back surgery, which he had fairly recently, you know, being okay with the people left behind, being okay with Triple H running a really disrespectful skit about Vince getting surgery? Of course not, you know. So it's his double standards writ large as well.
It's wild. Like, so 2005, so he's going through diverticulitis, which he notes it destroyed 13 inches of his colon, and he spent 8 days in ICU. And yeah, that's, as Neil mentioned, Jan, his late wife, saying, what's the matter with him after seeing the Dr. Heine sketch and asking and following, whenever we meet him, he's so nice to us. Why does he do this to you? The truth was, the chairman wasn't like anyone I knew. He could be cold and spiteful and an asshole without much effort. And this was a piece from The Observer on November 7th, 2005 that reports Ed Koski was the main writer of the segment. Those close to the situation said he was very happy to be assigned to it and was told to humiliate Ross as much as possible. Koski is known backstage to bury people who have been fired. And to make things clear, Ross has not been fired. But after all this, relations between Ross and McMahon are going to be understandably strained as much as possible by doing comedy impersonations of them, which some feel are tasteless. While discussing the segment with the fellow writers, Koski acted out some of the segments while emulating Ross's voice, talking out of his mouth like Ed Ferrara did in the Nitro segment and making fun of Ross's Bell's palsy. Vince was said to have loved it and came up with some of the ideas of his own after Koski outlined it. The description of this is Koski's JR impersonation made the Oklahoma character on Nitro seem respectful. According to those in the company, Ross was said to have been called both before and after the segment to both alert him what they were doing and asking for his feedback on it. As for the reasons for the segment, given that it wasn't to build sympathy on Ross for an eventual return, it was said that McMahon was mad because the details of his failed plan regarding Goldberg came out. He somehow tried to make Ross the scapegoat for his looking bad, even though that makes no sense. He's referring to Mike Goldberg, not Bill Goldberg, who was the UFC announcer they were trying to court at the time. Now, when it's mentioned there, this is, again, just right after the segment airs, the idea they contacted Ross. In the book, you get the sense it was hardly like they outlined what it was. Hey, tune in tonight. We're going to be talking about, we're going to have something about you. They had no, there was no description of what was going to be done, much less any kind of like, hey, we're going to do this and getting Ross's seal of approval. I mean, I honestly look at this as like one of the most tasteless things the company has done in terms of an angle and using their television as Vince McMahon's playground, that it seemed, you know, Ed Koski was more than happy to volunteer. And the idea of just mocking this guy's Bell's palsy behind closed doors, I mean, it really does paint the real underbelly of the DNA of a lot of this company in this period.
Yeah. And for those who don't remember, not do a deep dive on it, but Vince is in this skit. He describes himself as Dr. Heine, a proctologist. So he's doing the surgery.
Yeah, with like nurse slobber knockers or something.
Nurse slobber knockers. And then there's some other sort of just who doesn't say anything guy. And
who was a writer, Alex Greenfield.
Really? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. He was a SmackDown writer at the time.
And so there's this dummy of Ross. You just see the Stetson sort of toward the camera. And then there's this prosthetic ass. And Vince just proceeds to pull all this stuff out of the... And there's fart noises and toilet flushing noises. He pulls out a football helmet, Mae Young's other hand. Some of this might sound amusing. It's not, believe me, if you want to watch this.
It doesn't sound amusing. It's not like there is even like... It's not like you can even justify it that like there's some joke that lands in all of this. Like it's not, like even if you are someone that is a fan of like super dark humor, like this isn't even it. Like this just taps into just baseline, lowest common denominator type of like humor. And the punchline at the end is he pulls out, I guess it's a photo of Jim Ross stating
like a mannequin sort of.
Yeah. It's with the line that you've had your head up your ass all this time. And this is for someone that's been written off of television and has no plans to return. It's not like this is building up to some big comeback for Jim Ross. He's going to get his comeuppance on Vince. Like Jim Ross is out of their plans. And this is when Joey Styles is calling the show. Like they have moved on from Jim Ross at this period, and there is no expectation of him returning at all during this period. It's just to mess with him.
And another insight into the character of Vince McMahon, the sketch ends with him just sweeping the dummy off the table and climbing on top of the nurse, and that's where the camera pans away. So you're left with the impression he's about to have sex with this nurse. It's insane, John. It's absolutely insane.
For the rest of our review of Under the Black Hat by Jim Ross, consider subscribing to the Double Double or Espresso tiers at postwrestlingcafe.com. We are back next month with a book club covering Say Hello to the Bad Guys by Mark Raimondi.